Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, March 6th. The war in the Middle East is now 152 days old. I'm Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President for Research here at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. The tension is rising in the Middle East. You can feel it between the White House rhetoric, the hostage talks, the rockets out of Lebanon, and the approaching holiday of Ramadan. One gets the distinct sense that a big time drama is brewing. I'm not going to try to predict how all this plays out, but I am here to help unpack it for you. So keep tuning in here at the FDD Morning Brief, and I'll continue to share what I'm watching and what I'm hearing. American journalist Benjamin Weingarten will be joining us shortly. He writes for Real Clear Investigations and Newsweek, The Federalist, and other publications. Lately, he's been cranking out some really good work on Qatar. We'll talk to him in just a few minutes about that. But first, I want to talk about Yahya Sinwar. We all know that Yahya Sinwar duped Israeli intelligence into believing that Hamas wanted to prevent future wars in Gaza only to attack Israel on October 7th. The full details of this will one day emerge. Some Israeli sources think that Sinwar may not have expected 10/7 to be as deadly as it was. The massacre at the Nova Music Festival in particular may not have been part of the original plan. But Sinwar did know that he would unleash the full fury of the IDF. He just believed that Hezbollah would come to his aid by opening up a full-blown second front. And that obviously didn't happen. But just because it didn't happen doesn't mean that it won't. This is Sinwar's plan. The Hamas chief, who's been living in tunnels for five long months, is shooting the moon. He's hoping Lebanon will explode. He's hoping the West Bank and Jerusalem will erupt during Ramadan. And he thinks that maybe Iran might reactivate those militias in Iraq and Syria too. Sinwar has been incommunicado for about a week. He's apparently not in touch with the other Hamas leaders. But before his radio silence, he said that he had the Israelis right where he wanted them. Does he? I don't know. But I believe this war is at a critical crossroads. Either Israel prevents the eruption of multiple fronts and then finishes off Hamas and Rafah, or this thing gets bigger, a lot bigger. So here's my question. Is Sinwar a brilliant terrorist mastermind who's about to launch phase two of the 10/7 wars? Or is he a vitamin D deprived psychopath who has lost touch with reality? Is he both? We'll find out soon enough. Now for your headlines. Headline one, an ISIS cell operating just outside of Hebron was rolled up yesterday by the IDF, the Shin Bet, and the Israeli police. This was no minor thing. The cell had prepared 100 explosive devices, all designed to be used against IDF personnel in the West Bank. There were four arrests made, according to Yedioth Ahronot, but it's unclear whether there are more ISIS members still at large. The good news, the plot was disrupted. The bad news, this was a plot planned for the month of Ramadan. And it's a reminder that even if Hamas doesn't trigger a wider war in the Middle East, there are other actors who might give it a go. 4 days and counting until the month-long holiday begins. Headline two, after 5 months, the UN announced that it found evidence of Hamas sexual assaults on October 7th. It's unbelievable how truly terrible and dysfunctional the United Nations has become. It hasn't just failed Israel. It has failed literally half of humanity. I'm speaking here about women writ large. And this comes on top of revelations about UNRWA's support for terrorism and the silence of the World Health Organization about the exploitation of hospitals by Hamas. This list goes on. But let me just also note, it took 5 minutes for the New York Times to falsely accuse Israel of war crimes after that terrible aid distribution incident in Gaza. But it takes 5 months for the UN to see what everyone else already knew, namely that Hamas fighters use rape and sexual violence as a weapon of war on October 7th. At some point when this whole thing ends, we're going to need to take a serious look at the UN's many failures. Yes, I'm aware that they belatedly affirm the truth, but when it takes this long, does it really matter? Headline three, the Iron Dome air defense system was busy yesterday on Israel's northern border. Hezbollah fired a salvo of 30 rockets. The video of multiple interceptions in the night sky over Kiryat Shmona was really something to behold. Definitely recommend you check it out. But Iron Dome is not ironclad. At least one rocket got through and struck a home in northern Israel. Hezbollah said it fired the rockets after the IDF struck targets in Lebanon earlier in the day. The IDF responded again, of course, and the daily tit for tat continues. Tension continues to build. U.S. envoy Amos Hochstein continues to try to avert a wider war in the north. He met yesterday with Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. Gallant vowed to continue working with the U.S. on a framework that would push Hezbollah north of the Litani River. He's giving peace a chance. But he also said that Israel will not hold back if it comes to a more direct confrontation. With tens of thousands of Israelis still not able to return to their homes, the status quo is unsustainable. It's now my pleasure to introduce Benjamin Weingarten. He's an editor at large at Real Clear Investigations. He's a senior contributor to The Federalist. He has columns at Newsweek and Epoch Times as well. In short, he's prolific. And lately, he's been prolific on the tiny, corrupt, terrifying financing nation of Qatar, which is what we'll be talking about today. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, well, let's dive right in. The State Department has just issued several gushing statements about the strategic relationship, as they call it, between the United States and Qatar. And yet we know that the Qataris are sponsors of Hamas, and they've supported Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the Taliban and a bunch of other terrorist groups. And this is to say nothing about how the country bribed its way into hosting the World Cup and other illicit activities that we've been tracking for years. Why do you think the United States turns a blind eye to all of this behavior? What is the leverage that the Qataris have over the United States?
Well, it's a great question. And Qatar has essentially executed a double game where, on the one hand, they put themselves out there as a neutral arbiter who provides certain perceived advantages to the West in the way of enabling, quote unquote, or facilitating mediation efforts with oftentimes adversarial regimes that we in the West don't want to have official communications with. And Qatar acts as if it's a neutral party to these conversations. But when you choose consistently to maintain relations with those adversaries, and in the case of an Iran, for example, are a partner, if not a strategic ally of Iran, that speaks volumes, as does, of course, the fact that this is a theocratic regime in Qatar, which has turned itself into the seat of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the tip of the spear in some ways of certainly Sunni Islamic supremacism and arguably Sunni jihadism as well. How have they co-opted the West beyond serving as a quote-unquote neutral arbiter with adversaries, hosting Abu Dhabi Air Base, the U.S.'s largest such installation in the region, and beyond that, of course, through being a massive producer of liquefied natural gas, which obviously provides it some strategic clout? Well, they spent billions of dollars co-opting and capturing the heart of the West, a slew of very influential institutions, very strategically and very shrewdly. And that includes the think tank world in Washington, D.C. That includes our institutions of higher education as the largest funder of foreign funder of those institutions since September 11th of any country, even beating out China, which I think is very eye-opening for many when they hear that fact, as well as, of course, investing billions of dollars in financial assets and basically seeking to leverage the key resource that they have. And it's associated with the liquefied natural gas, and that is money, using their disproportionate money, given their size, to buy complicity and silence and acquiescence for their not only theocratic bent, but their terrorism support, and use that to buy quiet from the West. And when the West shares certain perceived strategic goals, obviously they become more than just a neutral non-entity. They become a partner and an ally of the West, and in America's case now, a major non-NATO ally, while at the same time having relationships, like you've noted, with the Taliban, with Al-Qaeda in the past, with Iran, obviously, with a slew of other bad actors as well.
Well, I guess in the words of Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, it's all about the Benjamins. You've looked into the Qatari funding of a organization called the Richardson Center and its role in the ongoing hostage negotiations. Tell us a little bit about that. What's going on here?
Well, the Richardson Center has taken in hundreds of thousands, if not well over $1 million from effectively the Qatari government in recent years. And they serve a role interfacing in hostage trade negotiations globally, but in particular are playing a role as a sort of intermediary on behalf of Qatar to interface with Israelis and Americans with respect to any prospective hostage deal with Hamas, because of course, Qatar is the largest or second largest state sponsor, depending on what rankings you're looking at, of Hamas, which they claim, of course, as they did with the Taliban and others, that they're just doing this on behalf of the U.S., that they harbor Hamas's leaders because the Obama administration asked for it. This provides us a channel that we wouldn't otherwise have to engage in negotiations, rather than that they're actually aligned with Hamas. However, what is the substance of any prospective hostage trade? Well, it's hostages for many multiples of jihadists, which will resupply the ranks of Palestinian Arab jihadist armies, whether Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, et cetera. And ultimately, that converts what should be a decisive strategic defeat for Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and their comrades into a potential win, and again, fills the ranks of terrorist armies so they can execute future attacks, as we've seen with a Gilad Shalit trade in the past. So what has the Richardson Center done? Well, on behalf of Qatar, they've essentially said, don't be critical of the House of Thani, the ruling royal family there, because that's essentially going to scuttle any hostage trade. Now, of course, the posture from the start, arguably from America's perspective, should have been Americans are held hostage. You use every point of leverage you possibly can to ensure that not a hair on the head of any American is touched and they are returned immediately. So if Hamas's leaders are taking refuge in the Four Seasons in Doha, and Qatar clearly has power over Hamas, then you leverage Qatar's leverage to ensure that those leaders are turned over, that our hostages are returned. You're not trading potentially hundreds or thousands of terrorists for innocence. The U.S. has taken the entirely opposite tact. The Richardson Center has argued that Americans, including American Jews, should not be aggressive towards the Qatari royal family, that we should essentially play soft and appease them. I think that's diametrically opposed to our interests and the way that a group like Hamas would operate. As in the Middle East, the strong course always rules. We have any number of levers ourselves over Qatar, that major non-NATO ally designation that I mentioned, Abu Dhabi Air Base, except the Biden administration, it appears, chose to extend that relationship for another decade. Obviously, you can levy sanctions or impose sanctions, rather, on Qatar, designated as a state sponsor of terror, et cetera. Instead, the U.S. has taken the exact opposite tact, which is what Qatar has counseled. And those like the Richardson Center themselves also have taken that tact as well. They are cynically, and by they, I really mean the Islamic supremacist movement writ large, from Iran to Qatar and Hamas, have essentially leveraged the hostages to make this war about returning hostages rather than destroying a jihadist entity, as part and parcel of a necessary effort, I think, to combat and deter Iran and all of its proxies in the region. And so they realize this is the sweet spot from a PR perspective. Make the war about the hostages. Let's get to a ceasefire, trade hostages for many multiples of jihadists, and then ultimately let's work towards an end to the war and the establishment of what would be a Palestinian terror state. That is Qatar's policy. That is Iran's policy, Hamas's policy, certainly. And unfortunately, I would argue that appears to be the policy of the United States as well, which I think is diametrically opposed, again, to our national interest.
Yeah, obviously really troubling. That Richardson Center thing just makes no sense to me when you think about, you know, if the Qataris are running the hostage channel, how they could be funding an organization that's directly involved on behalf of the hostage families. It's just really insane to me. But let's talk about something else insane. Let's talk about how the Qataris fund think tanks in Washington. Certainly not ours here at FTD, but they have funded groups like the International Crisis Group, which has been vehemently anti-Israel and maybe to some extent pro-Qatar, pro-Hamas. We saw the same thing years ago with the Brookings Institution. That funding has stopped, but you can see there's a strategy. What's going on here?
Well, I think Brookings was sort of the first domino to fall in terms of receiving millions of dollars from Qatar and setting up the Doha Center, which is, we can see analogs in terms of, which I think we'll talk about maybe later, the academic institutions that have also set up these Doha-based education city centers there. And essentially, I think the targeting of Brookings was in large part about picking an influential Washington establishment institution, largely in that case associated with the Democrat Party, that would not only give Qatar the prestige of a relationship with an institution like that, but allow it to essentially launder its own party line through that institution and perhaps cultivate allies that would later serve it in the way of policy. So it's obviously hard. There's a question of, is it correlation or causation when you look at money flows, personnel within a think tank, and then what the policies ultimately are. But it's clear that historically, Brookings's leaders, and that includes Martin Indyk, who was influential at the time in which the strategic relationship was firmed out with Qatar, have taken lines that were, I think I would argue, hostile towards Israel and probably more sympathetic to certainly the Palestinian Authority and Fatah, but also arguably Hamas as well. Hadi Omar is another senior Brookings official historically, who now plays the role as the Biden administration sort of man among the Palestinian Arabs, pursuing, who has in the past, of course, spewed rhetoric that's highly anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian Arab. And beyond that, of course, we have those like Shadi Hamid, for example, who was a leader of the Doha Center and has consistently taken a position where essentially, first of all, when it came to designating the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, vehemently against that. And of course, that's notable and salient because the Muslim Brotherhood is in large part harbored by Qatar. And maybe more importantly, Qatar uses Al Jazeera to promote the position of the Muslim Brotherhood. So you look at the personnel at Brookings, you look at the money that's flowed from Qatar there, and then you look at some accounts from an old New York Times article, people who interviewed to serve at the Doha Center talk about the fact you essentially need to toe the Qatari royal family party line. And you could argue that there's a corrupting influence of that money. And many in Congress, on a bipartisan basis, by the way, have argued that maybe there ought to be a good long look at whether Brookings ought to register as a foreign agent, given at least that past relationship. International Crisis Group, to your point as well, has played a major role in the person of Rob Malley, who is the former president there, and those around him in essentially pushing for the Iran nuclear deal, which you could argue was a proxy for a much broader deal, wherein the Obama-Biden administration then, and the Biden administration, of course, has sought to reprise this, has sought to make Iran the strong force in the Middle East through flowing tens of billions of dollars into the mollocracy's coffers, giving it a lifeline, and essentially legitimizing and swearing U.S. protection for its nuclear program. International Crisis Group played an integral role in facilitating those efforts. And then, of course, Rob Malley himself went in and was a key negotiator for the JCPOA the first time around, sought to do so again the second time around, brought folks in, or folks entered International Crisis Group who appear to have been part of an Iranian influence effort that he appears to himself have been a part of. And of course, we know he's been jettisoned from the Biden administration under the cloud of questions about those Iranian ties. Yeah, so if you look at all these situations, Qatar money is tied to essentially, I would argue, anti-American, certainly anti-Israeli and pro-Islamic supremacist policies. And you have to ask the question, what did those Qatari dollars buy?
And I think that is the big question. What did they buy? We constantly have to ask that. Last question for you here, just about the money that the Qataris pumped into higher education. You mentioned it briefly before. Do you think there's a connection between the billions of dollars and the major problems that we've seen on campus in terms of anti-Semitism, anti-Israel activism, DEI? Is there a Qatari connection there?
Well, those like the National Association of Scholars and ISGAP have put out reports trying to shine a light on and draw a connection between the, again, just massive gobs, billions of dollars in Qatari funding to institutions of higher education, including our most quote-unquote elite institutions of higher education in America. And they see a link between Qatari dollars and dollars from other regimes in the region as well, and adversarial regimes, to erosion of free speech standards on campus, massive increases in anti-Semitism. Like you noted, the link between, and I would argue there isn't an inextricable intertwining link between the growth of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and then Jew hatred as a feature, not a bug, of DEI. So Qatari funds again here, and funds again from other adversaries as well, are certainly linked to institutions where there's been a massive rise in Jew hatred, which I view as part and parcel of hatred of Judeo-Christian Western civilization. There's a question of, would the campuses be this way anyway, without the potentially corrupting dollars from adversaries? That's possible. There was a very interesting article recently in Tablet indicating, however, that there's also been a massive expansion in international students attending these institutions. International students backed in many instances by regimes like Qatar, for example. Obviously, if you change who the people are on campuses, and if those people are backed by adversarial regimes, and if they're more likely to be disproportionately associated with the kinds of regressive worldview that you're talking about, that's obviously going to have a substantial impact on the institution. So I think that there is more than, I think there is more than just correlation here. I think there is causation. But that said, of course, these institutions have been progressive institutions for a long time. Progressivism has sort of morphed into DEI as the key focus of it. And that correlates, of course, with Jew hatred. I saw this almost 20 years ago now when I was a student at Columbia University. There was Israel Apartheid Week back then. It was the same Middle Eastern Studies department, which are often hotbeds of anti-American and anti-Israel sentiment. And those are often funded by the likes of Qatar and Saudi Arabia and others. So I think there's a clear link, and the schools are wedded to this money because these international donors provide them a substantial lifeline. And I think, again, to the detriment of the U.S. national interest, are essentially replacing U.S. students with foreign students who in many cases don't have America's best interests at heart. So it's a mess of a situation, and it's corrosive and really antithetical to what these institutions are supposed to be oriented towards, which is pursuing knowledge and excellence.
Yeah, and I will say that just on top of that, the decision to rely on the Qatari cash as opposed to relying on the alumni, I think also perhaps weakens these institutions over time. We're going to leave it there. Thank you, Benjamin Weingarten, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, here's what FTD has on tap for you today. My colleague Behnam Bentalibu has a new piece in the Wall Street Journal on Iran's arsenal of ballistic missiles. Some of these missiles can travel up to 900 miles. Iran is exporting these and other weapons across the Middle East and Russia too. Somehow the regime is yet to pay a price. Tehran even showcased some of its weapons at an international expo this week in, well, you'll never guess where. Okay, fine, maybe you guessed it. The expo is in Qatar. FTD's Cyber Center is keeping a close eye on the financial fallout from a ransomware attack on Change Healthcare, a national insurance payment processor. My colleague Mike Sugden has observed how the attack from 2 weeks ago is still affecting providers and patients across America. He argues that rural hospitals that are already strapped for cash could be pushed to the brink. And finally, my colleague Ivana Stradner has a new piece in The Hill chronicling the collapse of the Collective Security Treaty Organization. This organization, formed in 2002, was Vladimir Putin's answer to NATO. Member countries included Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, and Tajikistan. Uzbekistan joined in 2006, but left 6 years later. Armenia is now also eyeing the exits. This, along with an expanded NATO, is good news indeed. All right, that's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, fdd.org. Read our quick takes on X at FDD, and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at fdd.org/invest. Tune in Friday for another installment of the FDD Morning Brief. Our guest will be none other than FDD's Joe Truesman, who tracks Hamas, Hezbollah, and other terrorist organizations on social media. This will be a good one. Until then, I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FDD. Thank you.